After he had fed the people, Jesus made the disciples get into a boat and precede him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. After doing so, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When it was evening, he was there alone. Meanwhile, the boat, already a few miles offshore, was being tossed about by the waves, for the wind was against it. During the fourth watch of the night, he came toward them walking on the sea. When the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified. "It is a ghost," they said, and they cried out in fear. At once Jesus spoke to them, "Take courage, it is I. Do not be afraid." Peter said to him in reply, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." He said, "Come." Peter got out of the boat and began to walk on the water toward Jesus. But when he saw how strong the wind was, he became frightened. And beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus stretched out his hand and caught Peter and said to him, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" After they got into the boat, the wind died down. Those who were in the boat did him homage, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." The Gospel of the Lord. For years, this gospel has troubled me a little bit. And the reason it's troubled me whenever I come across it, either because it comes up in the gospel cycle or just in prayer, the reason it troubles me is because I have a profound sympathy for Peter's position in this story. And I kind of feel like he gets a little bit rough-handled, right? So if we think about this as, it's always good in these stories, by the way, to remember that these are things that actually happen. These aren't myths what's described here in the gospel was an event in the life of Jesus and the life of Peter. The disciples are out in the boat in the middle of the sea at night, and there's a storm. And they see, already this is very remarkable, they see Jesus walking on the water, and they're understandably startled. And Jesus says, "Don't be afraid. Take courage, it's I." And then Peter, in what seems to me a profound act of faith, act of love, is moved to say, "Lord, if it's you, call to me and I will come to you on the water." So Peter sees Jesus walking on the water, and his response is the desire to do something extraordinary himself and to go out to Jesus on the water. And somehow he intuits in his heart that that in the Lord he will be able to do it. And the Lord affirms this desire that he has, right? He doesn't say, "That's crazy, Peter, stay in the boat." He says, "Yes, come." Peter gets out of the boat, and the astonishing thing, he begins to walk on water. Now, quite understandably, he looks around and realizes where he is. He sees the waves, he feels threatened, and he begins to sink. Takes his eyes off Jesus, and he begins to sink. The Lord reaches out to save him. I would have expected, honestly, at this point, and maybe this is like a sign that I'm affected by the kind of softness of our culture, but I would have expected Peter to get a pat on the back, say, "Hey, that was a good try. It was quite an extraordinary thing to even want it." I mean, I don't know that, I love the Lord. I don't know that I'm going to go try to walk in the middle of an ocean, but that's not what happens. For Peter's desire for an extraordinary act of faith, for his attempt at his extraordinary act of faith, what he receives is a rebuke for his failure. "Oh, you of little faith," right? This is the guy that just got out of the boat in the middle of an ocean in a storm. "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And I'm incredibly struck by this because Jesus wants Peter to get out of the boat. He affirms that desire. He calls him, "Get out of the boat, come to the water on me." But he also expects Peter to walk on water. He expects Peter to have that total faith in him. And when Peter falters, Jesus saves him, but rebukes him. Now, this is going to be a long one, by the way, so get comfortable. I think we've already gone like 6 minutes. So I want to talk about something, because it's what came to my heart this week in prayer, and it's vocations and the vocation crisis in our culture. But I would preface this by saying, I am well aware that some of the things I'm about to say are going to touch a lot of nerves and touch a lot of pain, disappointment, frustration, heartbreak, guilt. I know that. And that actually is an indication of how extensive our vocation crisis is. And all I can say in response to that is the Lord, who loves us and is merciful, has pity on the brokenness of humanity, and the church has pity on the brokenness of humanity, but we can't allow the fear of that pain to shy us away from really looking at and speaking the truth. So we have, in our culture, a crisis of vocations. And typically when we talk about vocation crisis, we first of all mean that we have a priest shortage, and then we extend that to say that we have a religious vocation shortage. I want to kind of expand that term today and say, when I say we have a vocation crisis, I mean we have a vocation crisis across all vocations in the church. And when I say that we have a vocation crisis, I mean that we have a crisis in terms of the faithful living out of vocations. And we consequently have a crisis, I believe consequently, have a crisis in people even wanting to enter into vocations. So let's look first at the priesthood. In the decades following Vatican II, and I wouldn't say this is caused by Vatican II, but it's a historical fact that in the 60s, 70s, 80s, thousands upon thousands of priests left the priesthood. It's a great scandal to the faithful. However, while the sheer number of people leaving their vocations all at once might have been unique to that period, we can't say that that vocation crisis is over. It's still actually relatively common today for people to leave the priesthood. It's relatively common for young priests to leave the priesthood. It was a shock to me the first time, because I kind of came through seminary thinking this is a problem of the past, but we don't expect the guys we're ordaining now to fall short. The first time somebody that I consider a friend left the priesthood, I was devastated, and I realized the vulnerability that we stand in. This extends, by the way, to the religious life. Religious communities have virtually disappeared in the last 50 or 60 years. I think that women's religious vocations are in a far more severe crisis than priestly vocations. Sisters, I don't mean to embarrass you, but we're very blessed to have the Dominican sisters here at the parish. I'm very blessed to have them at my high school. But here's the thing. I often remember that, you go back to, let's say, the 1950s. There were so many women religious in every city. There would probably be, if this were the 1940s, there would probably be dozens of robust, large communities of all sorts of different charisms, working in schools, working in hospitals, working with the poor, right? We're very blessed to have our sisters here, but we're so far from having dozens of robust communities in Phoenix that we have to import our sisters from Michigan, right? There's a profound crisis. They went through a very similar thing. So many sisters in the years, in the second half of the 20th century just left. And then, there's a real, only like a trickle of vocations coming in. It's problematic. Now, we look at the vocation to marriage, right? And we don't need to rehearse all the statistics we've heard about marriage. They kind of range across the board. But the point is, a lot of marriages end in divorce these days and have for some time now. And that's a relatively new historical reality. Now, I think our lived cultural experience of these things have had a few pretty serious effects on our psychology. I don't necessarily mean each of us individually, but I say like as a culture, some of our expectations, some of our thoughts, some of our behaviors have been deeply impacted by this experience of widespread failure to be faithful to a vocation, to a vow. One is, I think we have ceased expecting people to keep their promises. We really have. We do live in an age, I'm sorry, I don't mean to like be negative or harp on the culture. We do live in an age that doesn't really like guilt and wants to react angrily at guilt. And so we have basically gotten to a point where we say, it's okay, that's just life. It's okay, people try marriage, and it fails. It's okay, that's life. Somebody close to me, I won't say who that was, but somebody close to me before I became a priest, I was very close to ordination, said to me, well, just remember, if you're not happy, you can just leave. We no longer expect promises to be kept. We say, this is human nature. That's life. And we don't need to, you know, it hurts enough when things go wrong, so we don't need to kind of add to the guilt of that. We say, this is okay, this is what happens. You know, we're weak, we fail, no big deal. But it is a big deal. Right, we maybe what we're tapping into is that same inclination I have to see Peter sinking in the water and want Jesus to say, hey, that was a good try. You know, thanks for giving it a shot. But that's not what Peter hears, right? Peter hears, oh, you of little faith, you should have trusted me more. Right, as much as we want to have compassion on those situations, and they're incredibly painful, as much as we want to have compassion on those situations where someone fails to keep the promises that they've made, who can deny that in actual fact, pain and destruction is left in the wake of every failure to live out vows? Who can leave the priesthood and not leave behind him, in his wake, scandal and pain and like a hurt trust in the priesthood? Right? What marriage, especially marriages that have children, what couple with children can break up and say, nobody's going to be hurt by this, it's fine? The reality is, however much it hurts and however bad we may feel about it, there is something profoundly tragic about when somebody fails to keep their promises. But this cultural adjustment that says we can't expect people to keep their promises, right? Human nature is too frail, so let's just be gentle towards this subject. I think a further, deeper consequence is we have lost, as a culture, we have lost our confidence in ourselves and in our ability to make commitments. As a result, we're afraid. We're afraid to get out of the boat. We're afraid to make promises. There's a wonderful essay that G.K. Chesterton wrote called In Defense of Rash Vows. And he says, the nature of a vow is that you're making an appointment with yourself, or you're making an appointment that your future self must keep. And the fear of man, especially modern man, is that we won't keep it. The fear is that I'll be somebody different in the future and I won't be able to keep that promise. We've lost our confidence in our ability to keep our promises, and so we're afraid to make them. And we've actually become crippled. This is a many faceted problem, by the way. I don't mean to say that I can like diagnose the whole issue in just one little homily, but it also blends into our distorted notions of freedom. Right? So we've gotten to a point now where we think that freedom is the least possible stricture on our actions, right? The more options and the less obligation we have, the freer we are. But this is a parody of freedom. That's not what real freedom is. Freedom is for love, and the nature of love is to bind oneself. That's what love does. That's why when somebody falls in love, they immediately want to start making outlandish promises, because that's what love does. Love, by its nature, wants to bind itself. It wants to make commitments. It wants to give itself in a way that it can't take itself back. That's the nature of love. We had to learn to doubt our ability to live that out. I don't think it's natural to us, right? It isn't the nature of love to bind oneself, which is why, if you think about it, every authentic vocation in the church, right? So we all have a vocation, first of all, to holiness, but then there's a specific way to live that out. Every authentic vocation in the church involves committing ourselves to something in an irrevocable way. Whether you become a priest, whether you become a religious, whether you become a consecrated single, or whether you are married, there is no vocation that simply leaves us free to float around forever. Every authentic vocation involves us binding ourselves to something in the name of Jesus that we can't take back. And that is actually not a lessening of our freedom. That's the fullest expression of our freedom, because our freedom is for love, and love by its nature binds itself. Right? It was love for Peter that made him want to get out of the boat. As absurd, as irrational as that desire was, it was his love for Jesus and his desire to be with Jesus, his enthusiasm to move out on the water. That's what called him to make that rash decision. Say, Lord, if this is really you, call me and I'll come to you. It was love that drove him to do that. So when we lose our confidence in our ability to keep promises, and therefore we're afraid to make them, What's at risk is we're afraid to love now. We're afraid to love. And I mean, just give two little examples, then I'll move on to a conclusion here. When I talk about this loss of confidence, when I teach my my students about marriage, and I spend maybe like 3-4 weeks discussing the sacrament of marriage, one thing I want them to be is informed, right? I want them to know what marriage is. I want them to know how serious the obligation is. Every single year, though, as I talk to them about, you know, the nature of a vow and how it's an irrevocable commitment to something, some students will inevitably say, and hopefully I do a good job of talking them through this and out of this and tell them, no, marriage is actually beautiful, don't be afraid of it. Some of my students, once they're faced with the seriousness of the vow and the vulnerability that comes with the vow, the vulnerability, the fact that you're making a promise with yourself and you're making a deal with your future self, inevitably some students say, then I don't want to get married. I'm just afraid. I'm afraid to make that commitment. I'm afraid that I won't be able to live up to it. I'm afraid that I'm happy. Also, a few years ago, I was talking to somebody who was considering a celibate vocation, and they said, I just couldn't do it because I know that if I was unhappy or lonely or if I fell in love, I would leave. And so it's these fears that we're not going to be able to live out the promises that we make that sort of cripple us. And that's why, in addition to having all sorts of broken marriages, in addition to having all sorts of ex-priests and ex-religious out there, we also have a lot of young men and women who are painfully alone. And in general, people are getting later and later into life before they enter into a vocation at all. And then some of them get to a point in their lives where they suddenly feel like they don't have a vocation. It's a painful reality, brothers and sisters. I know it. I don't speak dismissively about it, but it's one that we have to look at and be serious about. So what can we do? What can we do? Well, I think what the light that this gospel sheds on the problem, and it's a complex problem, is it first of all reminds us of the need to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus. It's when Peter stops looking at Jesus and becomes aware of the waves and the wind and the threat of drowning, that's when he begins to sink. That's when he loses his faith. That's when he loses his confidence, right? It's his faith, it's his trust, it's his eyes fixed on Jesus that enables him to do something remarkable to begin with. And brothers and sisters, keeping vows is remarkable. There is something almost supernatural about binding yourself to something for life and then being able to live up to it. Marriage, most of you have a vocation to marriage. Most of you are in vocations to marriage. People will tell me sometimes, Father, I don't know how you live a celibate life. And I almost want to laugh. You know, I don't know how you do what you do, honestly. There's something kind of supernatural about it. We're able to do it, however difficult it is, however beyond our natural powers, because of the Lord. But there's an even more fundamental way we need to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus. And you've probably heard me talk about this before. Every single one of us, regardless of where we're at in our life, regardless of what our vocation, what our state in life, our happiness is to be found only in Jesus Christ. If we're married and we look to our spouse for our happiness and our fulfillment, that's not romantic, that's idolatry. And that's a bad recipe for a happy marriage, right? The man who looks at his wife and expects her to fulfill him is inevitably going to be disappointed and vice versa. And then the danger is you say, well, I'm not happy in this marriage, so maybe I better look for another one. I'm not happy in the vocation I have, so maybe I should try a different one. And so many times I've talked to people who were struggling with where they were in life, and I have to remind them, well, if you can't be happy now, you can't be happy ever. Because what all of us need for our happiness, for our fulfillment, is Jesus, and Jesus is always there. I think that I had more points to make, but I have forgotten them. So this is enough, right? We need to hope and pray and strive and begin to try to heal this enormous rift, this enormous wound in our culture. I think we need to sit with the fact that Jesus wants us to get out of the boat. He wants us to walk on water. Right? He calls us to take that leap. He wants us to make vows, but he also wants us to keep vows. And in order for us to be able to do that, we can't look at the water that we're walking on. We can't look at ourselves or rely on our own selves. We have to keep our eyes fixed on him. Him who fulfills us, him who gives us our happiness, him who gives us meaning in our lives, and him who gives us the ability to walk on water.